Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, nbpp.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Kasali, good morning to all of you, my fellow African diaspora.
Morning.
I'd like to thank our moderator for the most wonderful introduction. And I also want to thank the organizers of this amazing event, the children of Africa, who are truly saying, enough is enough. That our circumstances as black people around the globe can be better, should be better, and will be better.
Amen.
I was being interviewed by one gentleman about 2 years ago. And he asked me, Who do I listen to? Who did I get my inspiration from? And it dawned on me that actually I never quite stopped to think about it. But as I was struggling to answer that question, it suddenly occurred to me that while my father may be gone, that I still to a great extent listen to him. That a lot of what I do, what I think, those are whispers that continue to come. And he reminds me every day of where we came from. I was reminded of the stories that I grew up hearing from my father, growing up in the country of then Rhodesia, but prior to them British coming to Zimbabwe, we were none other than the powerful Monomotapa Kingdom. And my father recalls to me, and all of us in the family, over and over again, how our land in Zimbabwe was taken by the British. If you were a veteran of the First World War, or just an adventurous Briton, First or Second World War, you were guaranteed 2,000 hectares of land in Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, plus any loot from the local people. I repeat, if you were a veteran of the First or Second World War, or just simply an adventurous Briton, you were guaranteed 2,000 hectares of land in Rhodesia, plus any loot from the local people. The British were encouraged to loot from the local people. They even have that law in the books today. It's called the British Loot Law. Those on the ground, the Rhodesians, the British who were on the ground, they had divided Zimbabwe and Rhodesia then into four regions. The first region was the perfect region for agriculture. It had the perfect rain, perfect soil. Region 2 was pretty close to Region 1. Region 3, not so good, perfect for cattle ranching. And Region 4, nobody should live there. It didn't rain. The soil was like sand, like a desert. And it was infested with butterflies and mosquitoes. So the British set out to move the Zimbabwean people from Region 1 and Region 2, even Region 3, into Region 4. So when you landed in Zimbabwe as a British, you were directed in the Region 1 or Region 2 area. And the way a British marks out his land is by getting on a horse and riding in one direction until either him or his horse was tired. Then he would put his bet. And the following day he would wake up again and do the same thing. So it took the British man 4 days to map up his land. And when he was done, everything in that land was his, minus the people. They would then go to the villages within that newly acquired land, and they would tell the villagers that in this direction go past this mountain, in this direction go past this river, because your land is now mine. And the people left with whatever they could carry. My father was a young man of about, young boy of about 13 years. You see, we don't quite know exactly what his birthday was, but we do know that he was born in the year of the leaves. And when that year of the leaves, it just so happened that there was a year that was very peculiar in the sense that so many leaves were shedded. And everybody remembers that year of the leaves. And do you know his trip year of the leaves was 2019? Not 1919. So we assume he was around 13 years of age when this particular situation occurred in his village. As a young man, he remembers waking up early hours of the morning, and there was pandemonium in the village. Everyone was running around the village, scattered around, and there were these men on horses, men without knees, they called them. You see, when you wear pants, you look like you have no knees. So they called them the men without knees on horses. They were running around the village and clutching the huts. The whole village was ablaze. And everybody was running away with whatever they could carry on their head. My aunt, rather his aunt, was pregnant and was due any day. So they had to ask the men without knees for permission to allow her to stay until she could deliver. So they had negotiated that her heart was the only one that could not be set on fire. So they decided that maybe if we just left one young person, a child, just maybe that the British would not kill them. So it was my aunt, my dear aunt, who was pregnant, a grandmother who was midwife, her husband, and another sister, and my father, who stayed behind in this village that had been tossed out. And they huddled in this one little house. And my father recounts the biggest fear that he had every morning was the fear that this white man without knees on a horse would stop by every morning and wanted to know whether or not his aunt had delivered. Sadly for them, it took 3 weeks before she could deliver. And 3 days after she delivered, they were asked to walk. We didn't care where you go. Just get away from now, my land. And unfortunately for them, no sooner had they landed in what they thought would be their new home, before they could regroup, yet another British came out and mapped out his land. And once again, here they were. So they decided this time they were just going to go as far away as they can, hoping that no other white men would come and claim their land as theirs. That is the story I grew up being told by my father. And he would always say, where our land originally was, it was now the land that was owned by Oppenheimer of Oppenheimer Fund. And when we would drive past that land, you could drive at 120 kilometers an hour, and you were still on his farm. His farm was larger than the country of Belgium. And my father would always say, someday we will get our land back from these thieves. I grew up truly believing that the British were thieves. But then the little girl, that's what my father told me. And I believe him. And based on that story, you cannot deny that. So those who chose to say the way in which the land was taken in Zimbabwe, I would always say, let me tell you my story from my father. Let me tell you how the land was taken. And that is our truth, that we were denied. We were told lies. Then you fast forward over a century later. I often say, I'm the granddaughter of a grandfather who was dispossessed of his land. And then my white Caucasian friend is a granddaughter of the thief who stole the land from my grandfather. I'm simply asking that me as the dispossessed granddaughter, who has lived an underprivileged life because of the actions of your grandfather, and you, who have lived a privileged life out of the loot from your grandfather, it's now 2019. You and I, we know what's right. Let's sit down and talk about this. Let's fix this the right way. But instead, my colleague then says, I had nothing to do. This land is now mine. To which I will also say, but I also have nothing to do with it. I've lived an underprivileged life. What's right is right. And what is wrong is wrong. So the truth of the matter is, because you will not agree to fix this situation, do you want me to beat you up? Before you can do the right thing? Or are you going to be civilized enough and do the right thing? Because if the truth be told, going back to my grandfather, we have been the civilized ones. And you and your grandfather have been the uncivilized ones. How long is it going to take before you can do the right thing? And the story did not go on just in Zimbabwe. The story is repeated around the globe. The injustices that were told to me by my father, the injustices that I grew up with in Rhodesia, those injustices continue around the globe. What is it about us black people that we're hated so much? What is it that we as black people have done to the world to deserve the disrespect that we uniformly experience no matter where you find us on the globe? We are the most exploited and abused race in the history of humanity. And yet we are the origins of humanity as we know it. I often say, particularly us black women, we gave birth to the first human being. Without us, there would not be any other races, and that is a fact. What came first, the chicken or the egg? One group said the chicken, and the other group said the egg. Queen Mother said no. She said the black woman is the only one who can have a child without a man. She said the black woman came with the egg. The two came together. I'm saying this to say we are an amazing race as black people. That we have been lied to. We have been told that we do not matter. We have been told that we are inferior to others. Far from the truth. Civilization as we know it began in Africa and it stays in Africa. The history books have been distorted to begin when they want the history to begin. You see, they say history is history. We must have history and history, because history is yet to be told. From Berlin Conference, going back to 400 years, we started bringing Africans across the Atlantic to the fight for the continuation of colonization. To just downright continued exploitation of Africa. The richest continent on earth does not dictate the price of not even one natural resource. The divisions that were intentional, policies put in place to see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated and dominated 135 years ago, remain in place today. The colonizers on one hand, they say, we are giving you independence. But on the other hand, you must sign this document that you agree to continue to be colonized. And those who dare refuse to sign that document, they found their heads on the chopping block. They were assassinated. That started between 1980 and 1961, when we were quote unquote getting our independence. We're now in 2019. And the big continues. And the big goes on. The question I have is, how bad do things have to be before we black people can say enough is enough? France single-handedly is taking over $500 billion out of the continent. And by the time they finish investing it in their own stock market under the French name, they're realizing upwards of trillions of dollars every year. It's not that we don't know it. We know it. We know it's happening. Nobody's saying anything. That's just France. 75% of the natural resources being traded on the London Stock Exchange are coming from Africa. We all know it. But we do nothing about it. You see, when they send missionaries to Africa, they gave them strict instructions. They said, you shall teach the Africans how to read, but not to read. I repeat, you shall teach the Africans how to read, but not how to read. The same was perpetuated with the slaves. Keep them from thinking through things. Program them to take only what you tell them. In other words, put them to sleep. We've been put to sleep. Question is, how long do you choose to continue to be asleep? We have children, my brothers and sisters, that have no clue as to what we have been through, who have not experienced what we have experienced. They're going to have, we'll have grandchildren. Who we are going to leave this world the way it is. And they don't even know where to begin. Simply because we have chosen to remain asleep. We, the children of Africa in the diaspora, sophisticated and educated as we are, sometimes we are our own worst enemy. The African Americans are being told your suffering was worse than those on the continent. That the ones on the continent sold you in slavery. Do you honestly believe Leopold left a bed of roses in the Congo? Do you honestly believe the British left a bed of roses in Kenya?
No.
In Uganda? In Zimbabwe? In South Africa? Do you honestly believe that when they started and they were taking the slaves out of the continent, they stopped? I beg to differ, they did not. If the truth be told, the carnage continues. The exploitation of Africa continues unabated. And we seem totally powerless to do something about it. We have this unfounded fear of what may happen to us if we speak out. Well, I want you all to know that my father is constantly whispering to me that, my dear daughter, are you going to continue to be nice and ask your counterpart to negotiate with you about what belongs to you, or are you just going to take it? Are we going to continue to have Europe tell us that we are a diseased and dying continent?
No.
When they are stealing trillions of dollars out of our continent every day. You see, to a great extent, we have no one but ourselves to blame. The G7 gave us 261 million a couple of months ago to African women. I don't know some of you if you saw the announcement. The media went crazy because we got 261 million from the G7. Every journalist that I could get my hands on, I chewed them out. How dare you make us believe that 261 million from the G7 was something? This is not even a crumb under the table. I reminded them, do you remember the pact for the continuation of colonization that France alone has taken over 500 billion? When you put together the other colonizers, what they have taken out of the continent, we are talking trillions. You are sitting here and getting and using the platform that you have through the media and spreading nothing but hogwash propaganda. Journalists have a responsibility to speak the truth and nothing but the truth. But they are censored. We know better. We should not accept it. Come under the table. We should refuse to be lied to. No more. We must speak the truth. We know who we are. We know what we are capable of doing, particularly the diaspora.
Yes. Yes.
Madam Zuma was very clear when she appointed me as the permanent representative for the African Union. She said, my sister, change is going to come to Africa. But that sustainable change is going to be brought by the diaspora. Amen. But not just any diaspora, but the diaspora in America. You see, in America, we are already integrated. We are not Californians. We are not Floridians. We are Americans. That's not the case in Europe. They may be from France. They are Germans. They are Italians. That's what makes the diaspora in this country unique. And because you are unique, you have a responsibility.
Yes, yes.
No more shall we sit back and watch our brothers and sisters, our mothers and uncles languish in Africa because of what was done to us and what continues to be done to us. You see, as individual African countries, it is almost mission impossible to push back against the West. You must understand that very clearly. Do you see Togo pushing back against France?
No.
Do you see Iswatini pushing back against the British?
No.
And yet we seem to want to waste our energies complaining about the African leaders. You see, the problem of Africa, I liken it to a tree. We could complain about the leaves that are drying up one season after the other. And we keep complaining when the trees dry out. Next season, the leaves are going to come out again and they'll dry again and then we complain again. We're complaining about the branches that are drying out and falling off. And we never go to the root.
Yes.
And that's why we will always be noisemakers and complainers. And our problems will never be solved. I'm begging all of you to understand that what we are being made to consider as our issues are not our issues. They are not the real issue. They are not the reason why we are where we are today. We must address our issues from the root. And by the root, I'm talking about the Berlin Conference. And understand that the Berlin Conference is alive and well today. By dividing Africa into the tiny little economies that we are today, have you ever wondered why is it that to fly from one part of Africa to the other, sometimes it's easier to go to Europe first? It's because the African skies were closed. Have you ever tried to visit 3 or 4 African countries on vacation? You send your passport from Iowa to Washington. It takes 3-4 weeks to get your passport back. That's Nigeria. Then you send your passport back to Ghana, the embassy in Washington. In some cases, those embassies are right next to each other. 3-4 weeks, your passport comes back. Now you gotta send it back because you want to go to Egypt. Another 3-4 weeks. By the time you get your passport back from Egypt, your visa is Nigeria. So what do? You say, forget Africa. We laugh about it, but this is what Berlin Conference did. Try buying something with your Malawi kwacha in Nigeria. Mission impossible. So you know what? It's just easier to use the euro or the dollar or the sterling. Mozambique is an oil-producing country, but its oil has got to leave Mozambique and go abroad, only for Zimbabwe next door to buy it back 20, 30 times the cost. I was talking to a brother who makes some of the best ceramic tiles in Egypt. He said, my sister, I got to send my tiles to Italy, only for my tiles to be relabeled Italian tiles. And then my brothers and sisters on the continent are buying them at 20 to 30 times the cost. I was in Niger with one of our diaspora brothers from Ethiopia. He's a coffee distributor in the United States. He went for breakfast at the hotel where we were staying, and he comes running to me, and he had taken a few packets of instant coffee from Switzerland.
Yeah.
And she said, Ambassador, what is going on here? I have to come to Niger to drink coffee from Switzerland?
Yeah.
Coffee that I know very well is from East Africa? Mm-hmm. What is wrong with this picture? For chocolate, cocoa, 65% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa. And yet when we see the cocoa, where is it from? It's not, thank you. Sweet chocolate. What disgusts me, my brothers and sisters, is we know what's going on. And we do absolutely nothing. How dumb do we have to be? How stupid do we have to be? Is this going to be generational stupidity?
No.
Are we just stuck at the corner of stupidity and ignorance?
No.
Thank you, my brother. The answer is no. And that process of saying enough is enough begins with us. And that is why we are here today. To start a movement that we are going to say, as African diaspora, enough is enough. Together, my brothers and sisters, we are going to have a petition. We're going to start with France because France is the biggest perpetrator. You see, with France, you've got to understand it's downright cash. You see, when you steal from somebody, you respect that if they catch you, they might beat you up. So you wait until they are not home to go and steal. You wait until they are facing the other way to pickpocket. You see, France is not doing even that. France is simply saying, give me your money. They are just bullying African countries into, give me your money. And if you don't, I'm going to kill you. Plain and simple. So you see, while we want to go after all the colonizers, France is in a different category. We want to start with the, want to stop the bleeding. The $500 billion must stay on the continent.
Yeah.
the amount of money the African countries have deposited with France. We are going to claim all that money back. We equalize the playing field. We get France to be on the same abuse level as the others. So to the United Nations we shall say, you, the United Nations, the body that is the defender, the protector of human rights, why are you sleeping with the enemy?
Nice.
France is a member of the UN Security Council. How can we have France as a member of the UN Security Council when France singularly is one of the biggest violators of human rights in Africa? Singularly, France is the biggest risk to peace and security in Africa. And yet nobody is talking about it. So once you have a million signatures, we shall approach the United Nations. We are going to ask them, why? Why are you allowing this carnage to go on in Africa? Millions of Africans are dying every day because of the activities of France and other colonizers on the continent. Why do you continue to claim to be a body that defends human rights when you are overlooking the biggest violators of human rights? You see, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have this petition, and if they don't listen to us, remember what I said yesterday, that if you men if you black men who have failed to defend us as your wife, who have failed to defend us as your sisters, who have failed to defend us as your children, if you don't fix this, then step aside. Because we, the black women, are going to come together, and we will fix this. You see, in my village in Zimbabwe, when a woman marries, she submits herself to the husband's village. And you are told you must behave. Don't disrespect us. Take care of everybody. So the woman runs around like a chicken without a head, taking care of everybody. The husband's brothers, the mother-in-law, the father-in-law, the cousins, everybody is talking on this girl. And pretty soon,
what else?
She has children of her own. And nobody is helping her.
What?
10 years later, she's exhausted. She has tried to complain. Nobody pays attention. So what does the woman do? She takes off her clothes and she runs around the village, up and down the village, and suddenly everybody starts to listen. The husband even gets in trouble with the elders. They call a quick village meeting to say, what happened? What did you do to her? Why did you tell her there's a problem? But the woman has been telling you. And it took the woman taking off her clothes before anybody in the village would listen to her. But I got news for you all men. You better be ready. Because if the United Nations does not listen to us, we, the black women, shall march and take over the United Nations building, and we will take off our clothes. Arrest 5 million, 10 million naked black women. Go get it. being disrespected. We're sick and tired of our children being disrespected. And also because we are saying, enough. So the choice is yours, black men. Either fix it, or we women will.
We will fix it.
At the end of the day today, my hope is we shall commit to being part of the database. The African Continental Free Trade Area is going to be implemented in July of next year. We must pool our resources together, because that is the only way we can reclaim the economic independence that has been denied to all of us across the globe as black people.
Yes.
No one is going to give us the economic liberation.
No.
You see, we have what it takes to take care of ourselves. We don't need aid from anybody. Africa does not need aid. Africa does not need to be rescued. We can save ourselves. You see, 1 million people with $1,000, that's $1 billion. Can we not do that?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And then we do it year in and year out.
Yes.
When we focus all our resources into one bank,
yes. Yes.
The banks are going to protect us and fund our projects.
Yes.
That is how we get our economic liberation.
Yes.
No one is going to give it to us. We have to just take it. We are going to take it. And no one is going to stop us.
That's right.
So today, we are here presentation about the Domalink, which is the database that we should all belong to. Today, you shall hear a presentation about the Diaspora Fund, which is a fund that I hope we can all encourage each other to be part of. And today, there may not be a presentation, but what we will be pulling our funds together is in preparation for Wakanda. Of course, we can't use that name. It belongs to Marvel. But I have a plan.
Okay.
I've spoken to the King of the Ashanti.
Yes.
I said, Your Majesty, this name belongs to us. Could you please write Marvel and humbly let them know that we are taking on our name?
Right.
I hope you'll do it. But be what it is, these are diaspora centers of excellence. You see, the brain drain that has taken place over the years must be reversed. If the truth be told, no amount of money can deliver and build a sustainable Africa, because the capacity that Africa needs is in the diaspora.
Yeah.
There are more Ghanaian doctors in New York City than in the entire country of Ghana. There are more Nigerian doctors in LA than in the entire country of Nigeria. If all the continental doctors and African-American doctors were to go to Africa today, we're only going to meet 30% of the needs. So let's be clear about one thing. Money alone is not going to do it. Capacity building is where it's at. And the teachers and the trainers are right here. So in the Wakanda villages, we're going to address 7 pillars of development. Starting with the hospital. A nation cannot develop with ailing citizens. A university with technical colleges, agricultural college, infrastructure, hospitality, access to water, access to power. It's a new city in each region that is a developmental hub. All of that built by the diaspora in collaboration with our brothers and sisters on the continent. Into healthcare teams. Now listen to me and follow me clearly. This is a very simple, doable situation. Let's look at the regions. We'll divide ourselves into regions. The healthcare team in East Africa will map out East Africa. How many hospitals do we have? How many do we need? We set out to build them. How many doctors do we have? How many do we need? We set out to train. With a 5-year, 10-year, 15, and godly, by 20 years, Africa is done.
Amen.
We give up education. Same thing. We look at infrastructure. Infrastructure. How many kilometers of road do we need? How many do we have? We set out to build roads that make sense. Roads that address the needs of 1.27 billion people. Not people from Kenya, not people from Togo, but Africans.
Yes.
The expertise that we need is in this room and around this country and around the globe. And all we gotta do is organize ourselves. You see, the rest of the other countries around the world are preparing themselves for the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area come July next year. Where they know they're going to beat us is finances. We are not ready financially to participate in building the Africa that we want. And that is why it is imperative that come July next year, we must have at least $1 billion deposited with the bank in Africa.
Yes.
For people who are not used to big dollars, that sounds like a tall order. I can tell you, my brother and sister, it is not. It is something we can do very easily. But we have to unshackle our minds and begin to believe in ourselves and in each other. So when the database comes out, please be part of it. When the fund is launched, please be part of it. When we start launching Wakanda, the architects, please be part of it. Belong to your sector. Let's know who you are. Let's prepare for July 20. We want to hit Africa with a bang.
Yes.
You see, you don't go to China and find black people driving the Chinese development agenda.
No.
You do not go to Mexico, you do not go to Europe, you do not go to India and find black people driving the development agenda for those nations. You therefore must not, should not, and definitely by God will not go to Africa and find non-Africans driving the continental development agenda. Will happen if you choose to vacate that place that has your name. The choice is yours. The choice is yours. Are you ready to give up your place? Are you ready to let others come in and take over your place?
No.
Are you ready to say, my children, my grandchildren, your inheritance in Africa, I'm ready to give it up?
No.
You see, in spite of centuries of exploitation. Studies say they've only tapped into maybe 20% of Africa's wealth.
Yeah.
Only 10% of Africa's wealth. Yeah. And every day, more and more natural resources are being discovered in Africa, in your Africa, in our Africa. We come from an amazing continent. Endless riches. The heads of states are saying the children of Africa must be on the driver's seat. I have no doubt in my mind that now that we know, we are going to say enough is enough. 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 And now that we have awoken, those of us who are awoken, we're going to pick up our African drum and we're going to beat a beautiful melody to the world. And we hope those who are around us who are not yet awoken will join us and sing along.
Yes.
as we let the world know that the children of Africa in the diaspora are saying,
Enough is enough.
Enough is enough. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
It will be terrible. So, you were fired. Yes, take it in. She was fired. But why? Because if I have seen what you have done and what you continue to do and what people talk about you, you are inevitable, you know? Last night, Inez from Colombia was talking, crying about how she saw hope. For the very first time, she had the sense of belonging. Damien here from Niamey, I do believe that is where, somewhere between June, July, in Niamey, where we had the extraordinary summit for the African Union, came back, started a bank in 2 weeks. That is so much belief, you know? Last night, my friend, Olivier Kamanzi, pledged $500 to start an African airline. How many African leaders have done that? Now tell me, you were fired. Why?
You see, growing up in my village in Zimbabwe, I remember distinctly that I guess I just had a lot to tell. But because I had a lot to tell, whenever we had visitors, I would jump in and start telling them stories. And of course, as a child, you don't know your boundaries. And eventually, I was just told by my parents that whenever you see guests coming in, you better run in the bedroom and stay there till we come get you. So this issue of talking has always been a problem for me.
Well, I hope it's not a problem for me because I do love talking myself. But keep going.
But I have to tell you, the firing didn't come as a surprise. I had actually expected it about 5 months earlier. And a situation was brought to me, to my attention. It had to do with my videos. And an instruction was given to take my videos down from the AU website. And that individual called me and say, send me the email and say, look what I'm being told to do. I want you to know I'm taking the videos down under duress. I said, actually, those videos weren't meant for them anyway. The videos were meant for the diaspora. So it makes no difference to me whether they are there or not. But I kind of expected a phone call, an email or something after that. Nothing came. But at that point, I was prepared. If a message ever came instructing me to stop talking about France, I was ready to turn in my resignation. And then about 2 weeks prior to the firing, you know, you make friends. You get people who understand what you're doing. So some people had come to me and said, this is what's going on. Your job is on the line. I said, I don't have a job. I said, I have a calling.
You don't have a job, you have a calling. Now, Ambassador Arakana, we do understand that, of course, in the lead-up to your termination, right, much of that was, of course, based on the videos and talking about friends, but I want to just introduce this to the audience, those that don't know much about that, but even those that know. Yesterday when I was opening, I talked about Abubakar Keita II. He was a Malian emperor who was the predecessor to Mansa Musa. They sailed across the Atlantic 100 years before Christopher Columbus looking for trade. This is Mali, where
our AU commissioner, the chairman, Musa Faki Mahmoud, comes from. Oh, he's from Chad. My bad, my bad. Thank you so much. But still, very close.
Close enough.
So it was the Mali Empire, not the Mali country. But thank you.
Yeah.
Borders were drawn
That's
by
right.
the Europeans. Anyhow, where I'm heading is, you talk about the French siphoning billions of dollars every year out of the African continent. If I'm not mistaken, unlike the oil countries, the oil economies, you know, maybe the big powerhouses, Angola, Nigeria, and South Africa, other African countries as of 2018, a survey came from the World Bank saying that we did not grow by 2.3%. We did not go past that. And I speak for everyone here because I come from Rwanda. We have zero oil there, okay? Only maybe if we're ever going to find any oil soon enough. So this money that goes out of Africa that you talk so much about, how can it be put to use to grow the continent? Because we're looking at the debt and instability that is growing a rather very big vulnerability in our economies, which is leading to no growth at all. So even if we're talking the AfCFTA, that can't work if we don't have, you know, enough control over our own assets. What is the way forward to that?
Well, I often say, in all sincerity, that, and not disrespect, because that includes me too, that we as black people are probably some of the most stupid people on earth. That we have allowed stupidity to reign. All because we can't see it within ourselves to unite. No individual African country can push back against our former colonizers. You have to understand that the Berlin Conference was intentional. That strategy of chopping us up into tiny little countries was designed to create economies that cannot survive on their own. And should they survive, they're economies that are easy to destabilize. I'm not saying we don't have a role to play in our economies not moving forward. Yes, we do, but a smaller role. And it's a role that is peripheral. The role that our colonizers play in our economies today is at the root cause of our failure to take ourselves to the next level. When you take the issue of France, and I keep hitting on France because France is the worst perpetrator. France is taking actual cash. You see, the other countries, there is a bit of a challenge. How do you go to British companies in the various former colonies that are now owned by the grandchildren of the thieves? And now, those grandkids are now citizens of those countries. And in order to deal with that issue, you got to go through parliament and laws and all that. Put that aside. France, on the other hand, is just saying, give me your money. No good reason whatsoever. You see, over a century ago, we brought you a teaspoon. We taught you about a teaspoon, a fork, and a knife. We built a few schools and a few clinics and roads that only went from where the natural resource was and the nearest point out of the country. So for that reason, we shall call that the colonial debt, and you'll pay for it perpetuity. So two countries, Guinea and Mali, said, no way, Jose, we're not going to pay. What did they do? They went into those two economies, took everything that they thought they had brought to those two economies, poured concrete into the sewage pipes, completely devastating the two economies. That was done as a way of letting the other countries know that if you dare not sign this treaty called the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization, this is the fate that awaits you. So it put fear into the leaders. And the fear is real. There have been 67 coups in Africa in 26 countries. And 16 of them were former French colonists. Documented 22 of those coups were orchestrated by the French. Everybody knows that. So the fear is real. The only way that we can push back against these former colonizers who are very powerful is when we speak with one voice. When we are united. And that is why the African Continental Free Trade Area is a monumental decision. It takes us from the losing lane, which is where we were left by the Berlin Conference, into the winning lane, where we can now say we are a heavyweight boxer, and we belong to the heavyweight boxing ring. That when we throw our punches, we throw punches to win. So until that happens, Africa will continue to struggle. Africa will continue to be exploited for a continent that is every natural resource the world could ever need. We do not dictate the price of not even one natural resource. We all know that Africa's natural resources are creating billions of jobs outside Africa. And yet the same countries will look at us and say, where is the youth unemployment? And France gives us $1 billion last year. Oh, and all of Africa is all over the moon. Thanking France because you gave us $1 billion. It's insanity of the highest order. So our sheer survival depends on our unity. While we are working through the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area, guess who is supremely qualified to begin the fight, to begin the process of undoing the damage done by the Berlin Conference, the damage being done by the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization? It's us, the African diaspora. You see, President Obama, when he was running his campaign, he was a train that couldn't be stopped. Why? How do you block a million grandmothers with $100? You can stop that train. Fast forward. How do you stop 200 million black people, African diaspora, with $100? Are you with me?
Yeah.
And not only do these 200 million have $100, they are citizens of many other countries.
Yeah.
Try messing with that.
Try messing with that. Mama Arikana, just...
You can't. And that's why when Madam Zuma spoke to me, she said, change that we desire, sustainable change that we desire on our continent is going to be brought by the African diaspora. But not any African diaspora. It's going to start with the African diaspora in America. And now you have it.
And I just want to touch base with that exactly, because November 4th, you released a video where you talked largely about Africans in the diaspora and need to have a seat at the table where the future of Africa is discussed. And Damien mentioned a little bit of that while he was here today, that Afro-Caribbeans have felt like they're apart from everybody else. The Afro-Americans have not looked at them. But then also, the Africans on the continent have not exactly looked at everybody else outside of the continent. So how do we take that back? How do we have everyone involved in everything that is discussed on a continental level? Do we need to ask for permission to do that? Because, well, political willingness has not for long been a very, good thing in the back of our ring. So what do we do? What is the strategy to move forward?
When Madam Zuma appointed me, I was the last person to be on the shortlist for an ambassador to Washington, D.C. She went against many who had lobbied, including heads of states lobbying for their candidates. But because she believed that this was an era of the diaspora, she felt she needed to get a diaspora who understands the diaspora. So yes, I was sent here to bring the children of Africa home. Since taking over my role, I've traveled around not only the United States, I've gone to South America, I've gone to the Caribbean, and I have spread the word that Africa is calling all its children around the globe. The African Union definition of the African diaspora are all people of African descent living outside Africa. The heads of states are saying, you need to come home. January this year, they signed a decision which they call the ARA 400. ARA standing for return, and ARA 400 years. They are saying once and for all, and this is something that never been done before, by the way. How on earth had Africa not called on all its children to come home officially? But they finally did it this year. So we have a decision where the African heads of states have acknowledged descendants of former slaves as Africans, and that they need to come home.
A round of applause.
There's one other point I really must emphasize. See, 10 years ago, I said 7 years, but my girlfriend, she watched my video and she said, no, sweetheart, I know exactly the conversation you're talking about. It was 10 years, not 7 years. I was talking to one of my girlfriends who happens to be African American. And she said very casually, you continental Africans, you never have to deal with the issue of where do I come from. She said, this is something us African Americans deal with every day. I've been in this country 42 years. It had never occurred to me. I'd never wondered where I come from. I'd never even asked myself, where do I come from? But for some reason, that one particular day and that one particular moment, I took a moment to just say, I wonder what it feels like to not know where you come from. I put myself in her position for a split second. I still remember to this day how painful it was to be in that place where you don't know where you come from. And because it was very painful, I quickly exited. But then I kept asking myself, can you imagine a lifetime of being in that space where you just don't know where you come from? We had an incident about 2 years ago. A top executive of the company, she spoke after me, and I spoke about us people of African descent going back home to Africa, reconnecting with our roots. She got up and she described a situation where she was on a retreat with colleagues, and they started talking about where they came from. And one by one, they talked about where they came from. German Americans, Irish Americans, Jews. And as they got closer to her, she realized she didn't know what she was going to say. And right at that moment, on the stage, she broke down and started sobbing. I had to go to the stage and console her. She apologized and said, I did not mean to break down when I got on the stage. But because the time, the moment was right, she allowed herself to go deep into her subconscious. She reached that void that she has always had, and she didn't know that void was there. The truth of the matter is, this void of not knowing where you come from, it is real among descendants of former slaves. Let's acknowledge it. And it is that void that controls, whether you realize it or not, every decision you make, because you're like a ship without an anchor. And until that void is filled by reconnecting with your roots, you see, with the exception of the American Indians, everyone else in this country, they have their anchor outside the United States. And they are connected to their anchor. Until descendants of former slaves reconnect with their anchor, that void is always going to be there. And Africa has a responsibility to fill that void. Which is why the message must be sent out loud and clear that if you are of African descent, Africa is home and you're welcome.
Africa is home and you're welcome. Thank you so much, Mama.
And that you must make every step, take every step to reconnect, to go home.
Right.
We must take it a step further. And that's something we have to work on. That the decision of the sixth region must be made. Most of you don't realize the way in which decisions are made at the African Union. Issues go through the Permanent Representative Council, which is made up of 55 ambassadors from each country they reside in Addis. From the PRC, decisions go to the Executive Council, which is made up of the 55 foreign ministers. And from the Executive Council, it then goes to the heads of states for the final decision. The sixth region only ended at the executive level. It has not progressed to the heads of states where it is now going to be a decision. That needs to take place. And when it does take place, through our unity and engaging the African heads of states, it is my humble opinion, and I hope all of you can join me as we push this issue forward, that when you were born and you identified yourself, or your parents did, identified you as black, that there qualifies you to be an African. And as an African, therefore, you don't need a DNA test to tell you where you're from. You can simply say, I'm black. But furthermore, as we push this issue of the sixth region, we must also make sure that we indicate in that document that descendants of former slaves should be free to pick whatever country they want to be a citizen of. We are going into the era of the protocols for the free movement of people. The protocols for the free movement of people are in the process of being ratified. Once ratified, we only need 15 countries to ratify. Once ratified, Africans born on the continent can live and work and establish themselves wherever they want on the continent. The issue of the African diaspora definition as it stands today is shallow. It is incomplete. Let me make myself clear. Picture we are going on a journey. And we say, all African diaspora, all people of African descent, let's go on this journey. And we are all happy-go-lucky, feeling warm and fuzzy on the inside until we get to a certain point. It's a checkpoint. And that's when the security guard said, oh, excuse me, only those born on the continent can proceed. That's what this definition is lacking. You see, as a descendant of former slaves who is not born on the continent, you do not qualify for the African passport. As a descendant of former slaves, you do not qualify to live and work wherever you choose on the continent. So when the decisions are being made that apply to those born on the continent, they are leaving out descendants of former slaves. So that proclamation of the sixth region and African diaspora as all people of African descent, it is incomplete. It needs to be totally inclusive of all. And that's something we must advocate. And we want to make sure that when we take the sixth region as a decision, that it truly makes us all equal and it is completely inclusive, that our children can always get up and say, you know what, you mess with me, I'm on the next flight to Ghana and I ain't coming back. That is what true liberation is all about. So we're on a mission, and I can assure you, it's going to happen. Because together, we're going to let the heads of states know that we are coming home, and we intend to play our part in building the Africa that we want, and no one is going to stop us.
A round of applause to that, Your Excellency. That is rather very insightful, and I hope that so many people here that have not been to Africa are looking forward to go home. Yes, if you haven't been, please pay a visit. Now, you spoke about going to Africa. There is a mother, last night, she comes from Miami. She asked me to ask you this question. We're talking about the year of return. We're talking about having Africans in the diaspora come back home. But are leaders or presidents per se in Africa going to have some sort of a freehold on the land so that Africans in the diaspora that are coming home, that don't know where they're coming from, but are like, okay, I'll go to Ghana, I'll become a citizen of Ghana, they need to set up. Are they going to have property there? Are they going to have land? Or are they going to have to still, you know, buy out land as they do out here, you know, lease for at least 99 years or anything of that kind? What are we looking at?
That's a very interesting question. Let me give you an example. I had a beautiful young lady, nicely dressed, expensive makeup, expensive clothes, and this was during the time that temporary protective TPS, and the president was threatening not to renew it. So she came to me and she said, so Ambassador, is the African Union going to give us money so when we go back home we have somewhere to start? I said, well, young lady, let me take you and I'm going to put you here. Then I'm going to take an old lady in the village and I'm going to put her here. Do you honestly believe that you need compensation so you can go home and get started and not her? I had a young man come to the office one day and said, Ambassador, we Africans, you all sold us into slavery, and we deserve land concessions and mineral concessions, and he had all kinds of demands. And I did the same thing as well. And I said, well, let's take a janitor who happens to have been born in Zimbabwe, Liberia. When he decides to go back home, he has nothing. And then there's you. You also say, I want to go to Liberia or whatever. What makes you think you deserve compensation, you deserve mineral concessions, you deserve land concessions, and not that one? Stop being stupid, guys. It doesn't work like that. Nobody's going to give you land. All of us, we've lived in this country a long time. I had to buy land. I had to buy my home. So what makes you think you need to be given a home? Built by who? Stop being stupid, okay? We don't want this stupidity here. Nobody owes you land. You want land, you go buy it. Just like I would. Nobody gave me land. You, continental diaspora, did anybody give you land? If you need a house at home, what do? Thank you. So please, let's be practical here. Let's not fill our heads with stupidity and things that don't make sense. Did you get land in this country?
No.
So what makes you think when you go to Africa, things should be different? It's the same stupid mentality that we take with us when we go home. What you cannot do in this country, what makes you think you can do when you go to Africa? I had a sister who I got called in the middle of the night. An African-American sister who was traveling. She started in Nigeria somehow, because it was intra-Africa plane. She was able to carry on her carry-on luggage without being inspected. But when she got to Togo, and now she was getting ready to fly transatlantic, it is U.S. law, TSA, that says even your carry-on, we have to check it, make sure what's in there. But the sister decided for religious reasons, her luggage cannot be searched. And she also felt that because she's in Africa, she could just tell them what to do. Don't touch my luggage. Don't you do that. They said, ma'am, we'll take your luggage and we'll be happy to check it. If we don't look into it, we have to check it in. Well, she had already checked two pieces of luggage. And they said, now you got to pay for this one if we check it in. Nope, she didn't want to pay. She created such a ruckus at the airport, delayed the flight by two hours. And I got woken in the middle of the night. So you know, I woke somebody else too. I said, hey, you got your citizen who's acting like a fool in Togo. In the United States, they would have locked her up in a heartbeat. So you know what I told them? I said, you tell her in America, we will lock you up. And I told the security people, I said, lock her up. What makes you think what you could not do in the United States, you do in Africa? We need to go to Africa with the right perspective. If you don't do it here, don't do it in Africa. It is just that simple. Nobody is going to give you land. So get over that horse.
Right. Asokoro Ogaji has said that there is risk investing your money in Africa. What are these risks and how can they be addressed? It's a question on Slido that we've been receiving.
Again, a lot of his exaggeration. We're coming out of the recession in this country. We've never been through a period where investing in the United States was so risky. There are ways in economic development. But I can tell you for a fact, President Trump told the African heads of states in 2017 that his friends go to Africa poor and they come back rich. When you fly into within Africa, and even going to Africa, the majority of the people in those flights do not look like you and I. And yet you are too busy being told, do not go to Africa. Investing in Africa is risky. How stupid do you have to be? So yes, there are some risks. You simply have to take the same precautions that you take when you are investing in this country, as well as when you're investing in Africa. Do your homework. I often say to American businesses, why reinvent the wheel? They are diaspora from those countries. Engage them. Create partnerships. Go home with somebody who understands the terrain. You think you can just show up and say, I'm from America, therefore, you'll just listen to me and give me your money. It doesn't work like that. Do your homework. Understand what you're getting involved in. And certainly we are here to say, let's work together. So when we go to Africa, we do our homework and we make sure that we're more likely to succeed in whatever it is we choose to do. There's always risk in everything that we do. We do our best to minimize that risk. Africa is no different.
It looks like Moses is telling me our time is up, but we still have so much time with our lovely mama, Arikana. Just one last one. Your parting shot and when we should expect the next Africa Diaspora Conference.
Well, actually, we were looking at doing it next year. However, Audi is going to be in Houston. Hooray! Our very own African Bank representative. So we did not want to miss that great opportunity. So while he is in Houston, he has cleared December 18 as a good day for us to meet and take our conversation with Afreximbank to the next level, and this time with deliverables. So Audi, with your permission, can we comfortably say we can have the next event December 18 in Houston? There it is. December 18 in Houston, but after that Chicago has registered their plans. They said the next event should be in Chicago. So Windy City it is. And we'll make that announcement after the December 18 event. But the December 18 is specifically targeted towards Afreximbank and how we can engage Afreximbank to see to it that we reach the promised land of economic liberation.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mama. Thank you so much for your time.
Do you have any questions? Maybe we can
see. Give it up for the dynamic duo.
Ladies and gentlemen.
All right. So you heard that. All roads leading to Houston, right? December 18th for the Afrexim Bank Conference. Chicago, as long as it's in summer, we ain't flying in the dead winter time. Where the Chicago on that? Please, summer. And as they exit the stage, the band, yes.
Yes.
And as the Tari is Swahili for doctor. That's the closing remarks. I want to remind y'all, you may be seated real quick. If you have not received an email to give you the address to the gala tonight, something wrong with the Wi-Fi again, but the machine technology is learning. The address is 4000, maybe write this down or type it in your GPS. 400, thank you, Rispa. 400 West Las Colinas Boulevard in Irving. Zip code 75039. It's going to be in the Melody Ballroom. It's the Westin Hotel at 400 West Las Colinas Boulevard in Irving, I-R-V-I-N-G, City of Irving, 75039, in the Melody Ballroom, time 7 p.m. So yeah, 7 p.m. So we have a... We have an hour. And there's actually a shuttle that's running, right? There's a shuttle bus that's running from here to there. It's just a few minutes away, so you don't need to Uber. Closing remarks, please.
It's been a very long day and a half. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to really sit down and not live in the middle of the conversations. This was a time for us to reflect, a time for us to psychoanalyze, a time for us to have a serious conversation with the image in the mirror, and a time for us to wake up. We, the African diaspora, are the sleeping giant that must wake up. And with what I have seen going on today, I have no doubt in my mind that the African sleeping giant, the African diaspora, we are waking up. From South America to the Caribbean and here into the United States, please don't let anyone ever tell us that we're different. I don't know how many of you, whether you are aware of it now or not, we're having serious issues in our universities where African-American students are fighting with continental Africans. Some of you may be aware of what happened at Cornell a couple of years ago. They even took it upon themselves to complain to the administration that they were admitting continental Africans and Caribbean students to take positions that should be taken by African-Americans. I was asked to give a press release. I refused. I said, what is the press release going to do? I said, I am going to Cornell. I want the children to look at me. I want them to feel me. And I want them to hear me. So I gave my speech, and when I was done, I asked the students, I said, if the issue was the enrollment of continental and Caribbean students, if the issue was the enrollment quota, did it dawn on you that maybe you should just go to administration and say the quota for black students is too low, let's increase it? They looked at me, and they said, what are you talking about? And I said, if the issue was the foreigners coming from Africa and foreigners coming from the Caribbean, did it occur to you to complain about the Asian students? Because their enrollment is even larger than the blacks. Again, they looked at me like, Ambassador, what are you talking about? You see, the colonized mind said, go after your brother. Go after your sister. Then I found out that the same was happening with professors. The professors who are African Americans and professors who are continental Africans. The divisions continue. We must resist the temptation to be told that we are different. Whether you like it or not. My sister right here from the United States, born in the United States, when she walks right over here, and somebody says, who walked away? Oh, I saw a black woman. And that sister over there who happened to be born in Cote d'Ivoire, she walks right over here. They say, who walked by here? They say, I saw a black woman. Whether you like it or not, my brothers and sisters, you are black people, plain and simple. And anybody that tries to tell you are different, they are dead wrong. That is the lie that Martin Luther King spoke about. That we have been lied to. And how long are we going to continue to believe in those lies? We, the beautiful, intelligent, sophisticated, highly adaptable, and totally indestructible children of one mother, Africa, let's refuse to be divided. We are one, proud and strong. Let's stand on the tallest mountain and let the world know who we are. And together, let's join hands. You see, birds sing not because they can. They sing because they have a song. Let's join our hands and give the world the best melody the world has ever heard. As a proud African family, as we waltz our way across the Atlantic, back home to our Africa. Thank you.
Educational landscape. How do we, what is that Africa we want? What are some of those leaders? What do we look for leaders when we talk about the kind of type of leaders that African nations need to have? So that stirred up everybody, the questions that came in through the room. And it made me realize that there is so much that we have within us. But there are certain things that prevent us from moving forward. Whether it is your Kenyan accent, right? Some of us have thicker accents than others, but guess what? We're the ones sitting in those report rooms. Isn't that right? Sometimes our meetings cannot start without so-and-so in the room. Without effort being in the room. And effort is a woman from Nigeria. But that meeting won't start before her presence is in that room. So there are some things that we feel that they have blocked us. How do we unblock those? How do we ignite that in us? And so today is a power-packed day. And here to welcome us into today's session is none other than this woman. And let me do justice on this one. I don't want to miss anything. Rifa Abraham. She is a woman that works at one of the major financial institutions here in the great US of A. She handles risk and issue management as a project manager. That's what she does as a job. But her purpose in life, what she does to move the needle when it comes to mentorship and leadership, every day. She is the co-founder and partner of Anchor Network that focuses on bringing leadership development, mentoring, skills enhancement, and empowerment closer to everyone in our communities and beyond. Rifa is the reason that we're here today. This entire conference, African Diaspora Conference, she is the project manager. She is the program lead of what we do today. I call her my sister. Akoma, that voice that is needed in this community. I call her the power behind the movers and shakers of DFW and beyond. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the flip top
later today, the people who are tirelessly putting a lot of time, a lot of effort to make sure that we have a successful first African diaspora conference. And it would not be successful if you are not here today. So for taking your time, spending your money to come here, we say thank you. We hope that it will be worth your time and your investment in coming here. Musi has already given you the backdrop. She's given you what is going to happen. So I just want everybody to sit back, relax. We have a great program. I'm just praying that when you leave here, you may never be the same again. When you leave here, you have made a friend. When you leave here, you've made a connection, somebody who you're going to do business with. When you leave here, you've made a connection, somebody who you're going to partner with, to move Africa to the next level. My mother used to tell me. Mwana onenaye semreti. That's my language in Kishi. That means, my child, I'm depending on you. And today, I say to you, Africa is depending on you and me. The question is, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? So I'm going to let you marinate on that as you enjoy the program today. And I'm hoping that as I run through the hallways like a chicken with no head, stop me, say hello, give me your business card, and I hope that we stay connected. Again, thank you so much for being here. Let us have a great conference. Mufi, may the conference begin. Thank you. What time do we have?
9:30.
Perfect. So our next session, if you all have your programs, it is on transformative power of women. Women. A woman. Whether you're male or female, you're here because of a woman.
Yeah.
A woman births destiny. A woman enters a room and the atmosphere changes. A woman walks in and the topic changes. When a woman opens her mouth, people listen. Remember when your mom talks to you, you listen. A woman with a title behind her, people square their shoulders and straighten their backs. We're going to hear from women in business, women in entrepreneurship, women in government, transforming lives, women in health, women who have been the only, they have gone through the only syndrome, the only woman in the boardroom, the only black woman
in that surgery room. And this woman would sit here and talk to us about how they were able to transform the environment, the atmosphere, the places where they serve. And so without much further ado, I welcome our very first panelist, Esther Ukala Esquire, the founder of Impact.
Good morning, my name is Tanya Gilliard. I'm the CEO and founder of Impact Anchor. My passion for the development of Africa stemmed from being awarded the Mandela Washington U.S. Reciprocal Fellowship by the President Barack Obama's initiative to invest in the next generation of African leaders. Through that program, I was honored to work with my Yali fellow, Faje Long, to develop and launch Elite for Girls in Fashion. And that's a program that's specific to entrepreneurship, leadership development, and IT training for individuals who have the vocational skills but needed the additional skill sets in order to launch successful businesses. This year, working with another group of young African leaders, we were able to create FundWell. It's a microfunding and mentoring program in Senegal as well. So after meeting Her Excellency, members of the AU Region 16, fast forward, here I am, thankful to be serving as your moderator this morning. If you were here yesterday, Her Excellency Ambassador Arikana Chiambori-Kwa teed up this panel brilliantly when she said, "No more will we watch our husbands and children be disrespected. Men, we are warning you and putting you on notice. Fix this or the women will." Now that was a mic drop moment. She didn't really drop the mic, but that's what I envisioned in my head. So you're in for a treat, because you will get a glimpse into the world of four amazing panelists who are delivering results and getting the job done. They will share their unique points of view in the areas of medical, the judicial system, law, women's empowerment, and funding and investment. So buckle up, so it's time to drink fine wine from a fire hose, because you're going to get good content, but it's going to come fast and furious in the time that we have. So with that, let's meet our panelists, beginning with Effie. If you could provide us with a brief introduction and include the North, but also where you currently live and work and the African countries that your work impacts.
Good morning, everyone. How are we all doing?
Good morning.
Wonderful. My name is Effie Ukala. I work at J.P. Morgan as the Vice President and Assistant General Counsel. At night, I work on my nonprofit called Impact Her. Impact Her is a nonprofit that focuses on helping African female-led business owners build scalable businesses, get access to investors and new markets. To date, we have trained over 4,500 African female business owners on a pro bono basis that is free in 38 African countries.
Okay, and next we'll just go down the line.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Mercy Mumba. I am an assistant professor of nursing at the Compton College of Nursing with the University of Alabama, so I have to plug in a roll tie somewhere in there. If you are LSU, do I have any LSU funds in the room? I'm throwing some shade, it's okay. I also serve as the Vice President of the International Organization for African Nurses, so if you have some time later, please feel free to stop by our table in the back. But I have a PhD in nursing and a Bachelor's of Science in nursing, and that's what I do. On the side, I love to take nursing students to Zambia, Africa, for medical mission trips every summer, where we provide free medical clinics in Zambia in some rural areas, and we see over 2,000 people every year when we go. So that's just a little bit about me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a lot better. Good morning to all of you. I am so happy to be here. I want to give a shout out to my good friend, Amar Enya, who moderated on yesterday and invited me to be here today. I'm Dorothy Brown Cook. I am the clerk of the circuit court for Cook County, Illinois. Cook County is the second largest county in the country, I would say. We're larger than 36 states. And so being the clerk of the circuit court of the second largest court system in the country, maybe even the world, is very significant. And I was elected to this position in the year 2000, and I'm the first African American to ever hold the office. So I'm very, very elated and proud of that. But with that, it is a great accomplishment for the next generation. I don't see it as so much for myself as it is for the next generation. We are responsible for record keeping for all of the court systems. Many states actually have court systems that are disparate, but I have a consolidated court system. So anything related to the judicial system, whether that be criminal, juvenile, civil, if you want to get a divorce, or whatever the situation is, I have the responsibility, don't get a divorce. I have the responsibility for maintaining that record. So the records that I maintain affect people's freedom. It affects their lives. It affects what their property, the wills and estates. And so it's very significant. And the country that I really have had the most effect on in Africa is Uganda, because I've had two African delegations to come over from Uganda to actually see how I do things in my court system. Now, I've hosted many international delegations from various countries. However, these two from Uganda have been very important to me to see my people live and in charge in their countries. It's just been very significant. And I have many Africans working for me. My chief of staff is from Nigeria. I'm probably the only ex-official in the country with a chief of staff that is a Nigerian. His name is Wasu Fashin, and I'm very proud of him. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How many of you are from Kenya? Thank you so much for having me. Ms. Tonya, thank you so much for being our able moderator. My name is Jean Ayako. I'm from Kenya. I'm a registered nurse by profession. I'm a child nurse. I went to Binghamton University in New York. How many of you went there? Do you even know where that is? Anyway, I got my bachelor's degree in nursing from Binghamton University and moved to Texas in 2009. Now in 2016, I founded Queens of the Nile, and this organization was founded to empower Kenyan women from Nyanza region, because for a very long time we were very quiet about political and social change in Kenya. So the reason this group was backed, it started as a social media group, and now it's a non-governmental organization. The group was bound to allow these women to step up into leadership and to speak up and not allow somebody else to speak up for you and to be part of decision makers in the country. I come from a country where most of the lawmakers are male. We want more women, especially from the Nyanza region, to speak, because as Honorable Mary Matani said, if you don't make a choice, unfortunately, somebody else will make a choice for you, and it might not be a good choice. So my organization empowers women to step up and speak up and be part of leadership and challenge things that don't sit well with you. That's amazing.
Excellent. Faces, I tell you, very impressive array of talent here. So audience members, please remember to ask questions in the Slido app, and we'll display the link here if you weren't here on yesterday so that you could ask your questions and also vote on the questions that you would like to have asked at the end of this particular panel. With that, Effie, could you share with us what was the impetus for starting Impact Her?
Sure.
So I think I forgot to mention when I introduced myself, my background is that I'm an investment lawyer. I started Impact Her while working at an investment house. This firm focused on investing solely in Sub-Saharan Africa. So what they do is they raise funds, they look for businesses in Sub-Saharan Africa that needed funding to grow, and they make investments. As a result of that, being on the investment committee, the committee that made the decision on who should be invested in, I would travel throughout Africa, Zimbabwe, Madagascar, Mozambique, looking at the businesses that were in the pipeline. Doing all of this, I noticed a recurring theme. We were going to many male-led businesses. Not a lot of women coming up to the table to say, I want to grow my business, I need money. The few that came, very impressive women, in fact, I would take my hat off from them, for them, and would want to learn from them, I noticed that they still wouldn't make it past a certain point. That got me thinking, obviously, African women also need money, not just the men. What's going on? Started doing a bit of research and realized like there were all of this like beautiful research done. At that point, the IFC, which is affiliated with the World Bank, had estimated about a $300 billion gap for women business owners worldwide. For when you then drill lower down, the AFDB, the African Development Bank, had said that gap was $42 billion. Beautiful research. I'm a good writer. I'm a lawyer. I have two choices. I could sit and join and write, or I could take action and try to move the needle. I decided to move the needle. So that was really how Impact Her started. Putting this going out, finding out those women who needed the money and helping them to get access. And as I mentioned earlier today, we have been able to train about 4,500 women from 38 African countries and connecting them to investors worth over $1 billion.
Excellent. And Dr. Mumba, you shared earlier that you take students to Zambia. Could you share a little bit more about the work that you're doing related to free healthcare services for vulnerable populations?
Sure. So my journey started in 2014. I was still in the PhD program at that time, and I went to UT Arlington. Do I have any UT grads in the room? Go, so I was in the PhD program at that point, and I went to a women's conference. It was the Joyce Myers conference, and during the intermission, I saw the commercial about looking for nurses to go to Zambia for medical missions. And I was like, that's odd. I have never seen anyone going to Zambia for medical missions. I've heard of people going to medical missions to war-torn countries, and Zambia was not one of them. So I got very interested. Now, I grew up in Zambia. I was born and raised in Zambia, and I moved to the United States in 2006. So I thought, you know, I knew what I was getting into. And when I went on that first mission trip, we were in the outskirts. And I think that just like most of us who may be here, we grew up in the city. And we're also a little bit out of touch with what's happening in the rural areas of the country that we're actually coming from. And when I saw that need, it was a desperate need, and I told myself, I have to do something about this. So when I started working as a professor, I talked to my dean, which when we talk about having influence and being able to sit at the table with decision makers, we have to have that voice that advocates for our people. So I said, I am willing to take some nursing students to Zambia, Africa on medical missions. We have been sending nursing students up to this point to Greece, Bolivia, China, but we had never been to Africa. So I offered to take our nursing students, and I thought, well, you know, we're going to have five maybe be interested. When I held the interest session, I had 50 students show up, and I was only about 10 spots. And I was like, I cannot send 40 rejection letters. So I went back to my dean and I said, would you mind increasing the number of students that I can take? So she allowed me to take 20 that first time. And when I tell you that, you know, they were excited, we worked with the Ministry of Health to provide some healthcare providers like doctors and nurses to work with us in the clinics. And we went there and I thought maybe five people would show up. The first day that we had the clinic, when we walked in, we had over 200 people waiting for us to start the clinic. And our students were overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed. But what we found was people were desperate for health care. I don't know about you, my president, when he's sick in Zambia, doesn't go to a Zambian hospital. He's flown out somewhere. And that's the state of affairs for most hospitals in the African continent. Our own heads of state don't trust our healthcare system. So how can we entrust our people to go to the same healthcare system that we cannot send our diplomats or our presidents to? So I felt I had an impetus to start working with nurses. I'm a nurse by profession. So I thought, we are the largest healthcare providers regardless of where you go, whether it's in the United States, whether it's in Africa, we make up the largest healthcare. But we are not adequately trained. There are very few bachelors of science in nursing, even if you go to the master's level, they are very far and few in between. So I thought I would invest in my country by increasing the level of education with nurses, by providing exchange programs for students to exchange that evidence-based knowledge. And when I tell you that it was very well received, I was actually overwhelmed. So in addition to the medical mission, I provide grant writing sessions for professors in the College of Nursing there in Zambia. I also teach evidence-based practice at the University of Zambia and at Lusaka Medical University. So I'm doing a lot of things to improve nursing and healthcare in Zambia. But one of the things that I really want to look at as a long-term trajectory is to increase the number of doctorally prepared nurses on the African continent. I can tell you that from the research that I have done, thank you. From the research that I have done, we have just over 100 doctorally prepared nurses in the whole continent. That's unacceptable. Because when we're running healthcare organizations, nurses need to be at those tables. But just like in the United States, if you don't have a degree, no one is listening to you. So we have nurses that don't have the adequate education to be decision makers, and we have to do something about that. So that's basically what I'm doing. And just the last flag, we talk about economic development, and we talk about economic emancipation. I love to say that a country is only as economically viable as the health of its citizens. So you can have all the ideas, but if your population is not healthy enough to actually carry out those missions and agendas, then we're not going anywhere. So thank you.
That's another chocolate moment right there. I'm going to keep again jumping around. Jean, you talked about starting Queens of the Nile. So what are some of the things that your organization wants to accomplish in terms of women empowerment?
Okay, so we want women to step up and participate in political offices, not just in Kenya, but also in the United States. Because politics, as much as for a very long time, women were made to think that politics is violent and volatile and we need to stay away from it. But the reality is, politics is part of decision making. Politics is how policies get changed. That's how we impact change. That's how we get things that are favorable to women. And that's how we can get rid of cultures that are not good towards women. So some of the things we want to do, and which we've done so far, is I've seen a lot of women run for office from our group. They're stepping up to be members of parliament in Kenya. They're stepping up to be CEOs and board members in Kenya. And we want to transform women one child at a time. We mentor young girls. We encourage them to know that you are somebody. You are not just here to exist. You are here to impact this generation. And you are here to be part of the national cake. Because for a very long time, we've been cut off of that. And we want women to get educated. Like Dr. Mora said, which really resonated to me, I'm a registered nurse, and one of the things that we're going to do as Queens of the Nile, we partnered with Startup Africa
to go back to Nyanza, where Queens of the Nile was birthed, and get women screened. For cancer is one of the big things right now in Nyanza. Get women screened for cancer. Get women's blood pressure checked. Not just women, guys. I know men are looking at me right now. Of course, we're not going to shut the men out. Everybody's welcome. But we are partnering with organizations that are going to that encourage women to be, to just be us and to recognize us as beautiful creatures. They're not just here to exist. That's our goal.
Excellent. Thank you. And also, we hear about girls who are not allowed to go to school during that time of the month, right? So even partnering with organizations that provide just the basic essentials, feminine hygiene products, that could revolutionize their entryway to education.
Yes, you said something very nice, Sonia. So we still have that problem in Nyanza, where 5 days of the month, girls are not going to school because of their menstrual cycle, which is something we didn't choose. We didn't choose to be women. We were born women. Children are not going to school, so we partnered with an organization called Kinder, and any of you can donate. We provide sanitary pads for children, girls, who miss out school because of their menstrual cycle every month. So that's a big thing that we're doing right now.
That's something actionable, practical, that anyone can take a part of. When you were talking about women's foray into the political genre, Clerk Brown, you're our expert here, and you've been elected as Clerk of Court in 2000 and have been re-elected 4 additional terms. That's commendable in and of itself. What do you believe that the diaspora could do in order to support women like Sawa Dae, the first elected female president of Ethiopia and currently the only female out of 54 presidents in Africa? What can we do?
Thank you for that question, Sonia. I really believe that we, first of all, need to be examples to our for women in here in the United States, around the world, and of course in Africa. I personally have a class that I teach on how to be a candidate. You know, people teach about political office, and they teach about how to run a campaign, but they never teach a person how to be a candidate, how to run, not just run, but win an elected office. When I ran for this office back in 2000, I ran against 3 individuals that were already elected. I had never been elected to an office. And they were all white, and people were saying, well, this is the largest county in the state of Illinois, and it's predominantly white, and she's the only African-American, so maybe she'll win because they'll split the white vote. Well, I won 51% of the vote in Chicago. And I won 21 out of the 30 suburban townships, which means I would have beat any one of them. And so people judge me by the content of my character and not by the color of my skin. So I want to train people to run for office and tell them to first be prepared. Prepare yourself. Don't just get out there and want to run and don't have something to offer. Don't be qualified for the office that you want to run for. So I prepared myself first. I made sure that I had all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed. I became a CPA first. And then I became an MBA, and then I said, you know, that's not enough. I became an attorney. Because I did not want any question about whether or not I was qualified. And so once I did that, then I started running for office. But guess what? You know, after I won that first office, you would have thought that it would be easy for me. And I have to, you know, I have a story to tell. I want to train other people at how to stay committed and how to be strong and how to speak truth to power and stay strong and committed to yourself and the people, not be bought out. I say that I'm unbought and I'm unbossed. Like Shirley Kitten, unbought and unbossed. It takes something to take that kind of stand. And so the next time I ran for office, you know, I read in one of the newspapers where they said, if all the white people could stay out of the race and just let one run against her, maybe we can take her out.
So they did that. I beat him. Like he stole something, actually. And then the next time no one ran, right? Well, the next time they put a Hispanic man up against me. I beat him. And so what did they decide to do? They decided to put a white man and a black woman. They said, now we're going to really get it this time. We put a black woman in the race. Well, I beat both of them. And so, you know, I am committed to training people in this country, and especially women, about running for public office, and I would be happy to train individuals in Africa about how to run for and win public office.
Thank you. So you got all the degrees. All right, that'll find a job. Definitely. Okay, so we spoke about some of the challenges that you've noticed in doing your work. Let's make it a little more personal. What has been or have been challenges that you've experienced as a result of being a woman and achieving the level of success that you have? And Clerk Brown, thank you for sharing what you did. Anyone else care to join? And you even essay with another layer of complexity with being an immigrant.
Sure. Yeah, complex, right? yeah, so I think that the challenges, especially being an immigrant, I came here, I'm as a teenager, straight to college, to Chicago, actually, University of Chicago. Landed in the U.S., you know, I thought, you know, the grass is greener on the other side, so hey, it's going to be amazing here, you know. Applying to jobs taught me a lesson, you know. I feel like if I put up all the rejection letters that I received, I would probably decorate this room and we'll still have more here. And so the rejections were coming because of what I represented, right? A lot of times, like I remember having an interview with a particular company, a big company, I don't want to mention their name, and I was already like second round, it was going great, and they literally told me, oh, well, we have to sponsor you. I'm like, what do you mean? I thought you're not allowed to ask that. Like, yeah, you know, we don't want to waste your time. You know, if you require sponsorship, you may have to drop now, right? And that was how that opportunity was left. I did another one. And it got to a point where someone called me and said, you know, you send all those resumes and you're using FAU Kala. FAU Kala, have you considered changing your name? I said, what, to Jane Wilson or something? And this person looked me in the eye and said, no, seriously, you should consider that. And I felt like, look, I have a couple of months to leave the U.S. You don't get a job, you know how it is. You get to a point, you have to leave. And I got to that point, I had two choices, to change my name, I thought, or to leave. But I decided that none of that would be my choice. I felt like whoever was going to hire me was going to hire me for what I represented. If I had to change my name to work for someone, then that place wasn't for me. But I tell that story because I feel it shaped who I became. It allowed me to persevere. It allowed me to use my voice. Or, you know, another situation whereby, you know, I walked into a room and they say, you know what, we need you here because this Chinese client would feel more comfortable if you're in the room. And I was like, wait, what, is it my bank? Like, I don't get it. So you're gonna face a lot of the stereotypes, you know. During the hurricane in Chicago, a law partner asked me, how are you managing, you know, all the lights are out, are you putting like, did you take your furniture and put it in your room and make fire, like how you do in Africa? That was a serious question. But all of this allowed me to do what? It allowed me to use my voice later on. It didn't deter me. And I found that the more I went through those, I was in a better position to understand the other young lady who was behind me, the other one who came from Ghana, the other one who came from Kenya. I was trying to find her way around America to pull them along and to pull them. And even today at J.P. Morgan, everybody knows who I stand, what I stand for, where I am on the diversity committee. I raise my voice loud again. I'm Africa, proudly African, and I would represent my continent. And that is actually why they love me here. So I think that we should all learn to embrace it, what we are, the challenges, because they actually prepare you for what is to come, even when you don't see what is to come.
looking at the other side of that from an American who's here and joining the team is someone from an African country, then you could be an advocate for that person as well when they're not around, and to educate your colleague to some of the fights that are being spoken or things that they have as being misconceptions. So that's something else that we could do as well.
Excellent.
Anyone else care to chime in on that question?
I was just going to mention something really quickly. So when I decided to go back to school, I graduated with my BSN in 2010, and I had always known that I wanted to do research as a long-term trajectory for as a career. So I knew that the PhD route was what I wanted to do. So a lot of people were asking me, do you want to do nurse practitioner or CRNA or any of those other type of advanced roles? And I said, no, I'm going to go straight for my PhD. I went BSN to PhD, from bachelor's all the way to PhD. And I had a lot of skeptics. They were like, she doesn't know what she's doing, she's just young, she'll figure it out that it's hard. And it was really hard. But I figured those were my formative years where I had to learn who I was as an individual. I literally had, you know, I hate to actually admit this, but I had professors that would tell me, you're not meant for a PhD program because people like you don't make it through the PhD program. And people like you don't make it through the PhD program. And I took that personally, and I said, my father told me, you have to prove everyone wrong. You have to prove your skeptics wrong. And you're built from something that is stronger, and you don't let those types of things put you down. So I was actually proud to say that by the time I graduated, I was the youngest PhD graduate for my program. And I graduated at 29 years old. And fast forward, I went into academia, and they said, tenure track is really difficult for people like you. And I said, well, if I have to be 10 times better, if I have to be 15 times better, I am not just going to survive on tenure track, I am actually going to thrive. And I am happy to report in the last 3 years that I have been on tenure track, I have actually secured more than $3 million in grant funding, including from the National Institutes of Health, which is really, really difficult to get funding from. So I'm very proud of those moments, and I feel like I'm paving the way for Black academicians, Black researchers who feel like this is not a path for them. You just have to put your best foot forward every day. And tenure track is supposed to be 6 years. Just last week, in under 3 years, I got a unanimous vote to be promoted with tenure to associate professor in Georgia. So it can be done.
Congratulations. It can be done. And one of the things you mentioned that I'd like to highlight, you said your dad encouraged you. So men in the audience know that your encouragement goes a long way to support women on their respective journeys as women encourage you as well. So anyone else?
I was just going to say real quick, when Lupita Nyong'o says that she first realized she was Black when she came to the United States, I could resonate with that, and I'm sure a lot of you could. Because growing up in Kenya, nobody asked you to feel anything about being Black or about... We were just people, okay? We were just people. You come here, suddenly now you're Black. And not only that, you're a woman. And not only that, you're a Black, tall, brown, whatever color, woman. So for me, one of the challenges is I have to work twice harder at my job to prove myself. Because you're not only going against your white male, but also your Black male, and also your, we love you, African-American sister.
Yeah.
And you have an accent on top of that. So one thing I also...